All right, I'm going to begin with a little bit of a story here. This is a short story. Tommy was a 9-year-old boy that was always enjoyed going shopping with his mother. And one store in particular he really liked. And the reason being was because Tommy loved candy. And this particular store, they had a wall of candy. I don't know if anybody's ever gone into a store that has a wall of candy, but they exist. I've seen them. But anyway, and as long as Tommy had saved his allowance, his mother would let him select what he wanted and then use his allowance to pay for it. So one winter day, his mom told him that they were going to go to this particular store, and Tommy ran into his room to get his coat and some of his allowance to buy candy. But as of late, Tommy had been buying a lot of different things with his allowance that he had saved, and when he opened up his money box, it was empty. It was empty because, well, he had spent it. He'd already spent everything that he had, everything that he had saved, and now he wouldn't have any more until the end of the month when he got paid his allowance. Disappointed, he ran downstairs and told his mom he didn't have any money to buy candy today, so would you please buy candy for me? That's what he asked. But she said no. No, she said the deal was that he could only get candy if he bought it with his own money. So now, even more disappointed, Tommy got into the car for what seemed like a long ride to the store that he wasn't going to be able to buy any candy at. No fun at all. But while they were on their way to the store, Tommy began thinking, what if I just took some candy? What if I put it in my coat pocket while no one was looking and secretly eat it when I get home? No one will know, and then I can pay extra for the candy next time. Well, after arriving, Tommy walked in with his mother, and what did he see? The large wall of candy. And as they walked past, he asked his mom to buy some candy for him again. And again, she said no. They went down a couple aisles, and Tommy asked if he could go to the bathroom. And his mom told him yes, but to hurry and to meet her back in the next aisle. Well, Tommy didn't need to go to the bathroom because he had different plans. He was on his way to the wall of candy. He arrived at the wall and just began staring at this wall of candy. Then he began to look around to see if anyone was actually watching. And then he looked at the candy and thought, I can't do this. This isn't right. But then he kept staring at the wall of candy and thought, I really want this candy. And no one's watching. But then he thought, I can't do this. It isn't right. But I really want the candy. And if I'm fast, no one will see me. And no one will know. But I can't do this. It's not right. So while Tommy was dealing with this internal dilemma at 9 years old, deciding what he was going to do, he didn't notice that there was a store employee quietly watching and stocking groceries behind him. The employee could see what he thought, what he thought Tommy was planning to do. And so finally the employee piped up and said, hey kid, it looks like you're trying to steal some candy. This, of course, startled Tommy, and he turned around and said, actually, mister, you're wrong. I'm trying not to. Thought it was a cute little story. But if young Tommy was trying not to steal candy, what was he battling against? That's actually what I want to discuss today, what Tommy was battling against. And when I had this little short story, I thought, it kind of just fit the mold pretty well. Tommy was battling against temptation. He was battling against temptation. He was trying not to steal that candy. He was being tempted by standing there in front of the candy. He's tempting himself. Today we're actually going to look into this particular subject of temptation, but we're going to look at it in this manner. We're going to look at what temptation is. Then we're going to discuss where temptation originates and who it affects. And then we'll look at when temptation happens and why. And then lastly, we'll discuss how to resist temptation. Now the first two, what temptation is, and then where temptation originates and who it affects, we're actually going to go through fairly quickly, but we will spend the majority of our time on the last two and with some examples and such as well. And those last two, as I said, when temptation happens and why, and then lastly, how to resist temptation. And this whole subject came about, I have different subjects that I plan on giving or presenting, but this particular subject came about because I was looking at it last week for a teen podcast that I had to put together. And we had put a poll in for on the Lyft app for the teens, asking them what it was that they would like to hear in the teen podcast in a poll that we that was published on the Lyft app. So we actually had quite a few teens, I think it's maybe five or six teens that responded, and some of them gave three or four different recommendations that they would like to be able to hear different podcasts, teen podcasts about. And one of them was temptation. And so I started doing this study on temptation, and then it just kind of ballooned into a sermon as it was on my mind. And so it just, here it is. So anyhow, if you're a teen and you listen to the teen podcast, you may hear little tidbits of what was in the podcast, but this particular message is much, much longer than 10 minutes. Sorry. Okay, so first of all, what is temptation? How would you define what temptation is? You know, just think about that. How would you go about defining what temptation is? Well, I'll just share with you a dictionary definition of temptation. The online dictionary I like to use is dictionary.com. It gives really basic definitions that are usually just pretty spot on. But this is what they say about the word temptation. The act of tempting. Okay. And then it says enticement or allurement. And then it goes on to say something that tempts, entices, or allures. Okay, so temptation is the act of tempting, something that tempts, entices, or allures. Well, to do what? Well, to go a little further, we have to look at the word tempt. So let's define the word tempt. I'll stick with dictionary.com. It says to entice or allure. Okay, now we've already heard that, but it goes a little further. To do something often regarded as unwise or immoral. Unwise or immoral. See, we see that temptation is the act of being enticed or lured to do something unwise or immoral. Or wrong. That's what it says as well. To do something wrong. And whenever you think about wrong, you think of the word immoral, because the word wrong actually means not in accordance with what is morally right and good. So that's what immoral would be, deviating from truth or fact. So that's what we're seeing that this is. So all these words really explain to us that temptation is the act of being enticed or allured to do something that is not morally right or good. Temptation is an enticement to turn away or stray from doing what is right and true. That's what temptation is. That's dictionary definitions of what temptation would be. But what does the Bible, and how does it the Bible define temptation? Let's go to James 1. To see, just there's multiple passages where this particular word temptation is used, but we're going to go to James 1, and we're only going to read one verse for now, but James 1, verse 12. It says, blessed is the man who endures temptation, and we'll just stop right there for right now. Blessed is the man who endures temptation. Well, the Greek word for temptation here is pyrosmos, and this word is defined as the trial or testing of someone's fidelity, integrity, virtue, and constancy. And what constancy means is something that's unchanging or unwavering, something that's loyal or firm, or firmness of mind, faithfulness. That's what that word constancy means. But it's also defined as an enticement to sin, whether arising from desires within or from outward circumstances. So temptation in the Bible is described, and in this passage and many others as well, at least in the New Testament, as an enticement to sin, whether arising from within or from outward circumstances that will test our beliefs to see if we are unwavering, if we are loyal, if we are faithful to what is right and what is true. That's what temptation is. What is right and true? Now, that should be pretty simple. God's commandments are right and true. God's way of life. Because after all, God's way of life, and I may mention this whenever I presented the message on marriage, God establishes boundaries. He establishes those boundaries for our good. And those things are what it is that, whatever it is that God establishes what is right and true, cannot be broken. That's what God doesn't want to happen. He doesn't want those things to be broken, because, like I said, they're for our benefit. So simply, speaking, a temptation is something that will test us to see if we will stay within those boundaries that God has established. That's what temptations do. The test to see, test us to see if we will remain loyal. We'll remain loyal or faithful, we'll be faithful. We will keep God's commands or not. That's what temptation is. So like I said, we went through that pretty quickly. So now that we have talked about what temptation is, let's look quickly at where temptation originates and then who it affects. And to do that, there's just one passage we'll go to here as well to kind of look at that. Is going to go to Revelation 12, verse 9, and this may be a memory passage for many, but Revelation 12, verse 9. And because in Revelation 12, verse 9, we're told this. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels, it says, were cast out with him. This word deceives, in the Greek, is planao, for deceives. And we talked about temptation, but this word deceives, it's actually, if you listen to these definitions, there's some similarity. Because this Greek word planao means to cause to stray or to lead astray, to lead aside from what is right, from the right way, to roam from safety of truth and virtues. And then it also means to seduce, and seduce actually means to entice. And then this word planao also means to lure, to lead away from what is right. Like I said, this word deceive sounds very, very much like the word temptation or the definition for temptation. Because after all, as we discussed about temptation, temptation is an enticement to sin, to be seduced to sin, to be lured. And then this Greek word planao, it means pretty much the same thing, to seduce or to entice, to lure, to lead astray from safety or truth. So ultimately, temptations to do what is wrong, and that's what temptations are, to do something that is wrong, something that is totally against the morality that God has established, originates from who? It's none other than Satan the devil. That's where it originates. And then right here, as we read here in Revelation 12, 9, we see not only where it originates, but we see who it affects. Who does it affect? The whole world. The whole world. Satan tempts the whole world. He deceives the whole world. He tempts the whole world. And you know, like I think we've pretty much established that temptation is not really any different than deception. Because to deceive is to mislead. And to falsely persuade others to do something that is not right. So Satan is a master at this. He's a master at this, and because this is his nature, it's who he is. And he has affected, and I'll say has affected, everyone with his mindset. And I say has affected because he has affected us all. Because he even talks about how he's deceived the whole world. But he's affected all of us at one time or another. But today, God has called people to not be affected. That's us in this room. He's called us to not be affected by Satan's nature, his influence, his deceptions, his temptations. And we're told in Ephesians 2, verse 2, that Satan is the prince and power of the air. He's the spirit that works in the sons of disobedience. I mean, think about this. Have you ever been just kind of walking along or driving along or singing along, whatever it may be, and this thought comes into your head? And you go, where did that thought come from? Anybody ever get that? Nobody? I'm the only one? Okay, yeah, everybody. All right. Absolutely. Where do you think that came from? None other than Satan the devil. Why does he do that? He wants us to begin thinking about these things. That's what he wants. He wants us to think things that are against God's way of life. He is the prince and power of the air. We don't see whatever it is that he puts out there because he's spirit. He's powerful. God gave him his power. God hasn't taken it away. Not yet. And he goes about and he uses, see, because he is so evil and he is such a wretched being, he wants to make everybody else the same way. He wants to, of course, thwart God's plan, and that's how he goes about doing it. It's, you know, and this is one thing, though. He influences and he deceives and he tempts. That's what he does. That's who he is. He's the tempter, the great tempter. But he can't make that decision for you. He can't make those decisions for you. He can't make you want to do that. You have to want to do that. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But like I said, real quickly, we see what temptation is and we see where temptation originates and who's affected. All of us can be affected by it. And even today, even as members within the church, either baptized or not, you know what's right, you know what's wrong, we can still fall prey to temptation. We can. And so that's why I wanted to talk about this today. So we're going to now talk about when temptation arises, when it happens, and why. And we're going to spend a little bit more time on this. So let's dig into this by going back to James 1. And we're going to read past James 1, verse 12. We'll start back with James 1, verse 12, but we're going to read past it. Verse 12, we read, once again, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been proved," and we'll come back to this later, "he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." All right, keep reading. "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone." So I want to stop right here because we're told right here, and we've already discussed where temptation comes from, where it originates from, but I want to highlight that temptation never comes from God. We're told right here, it doesn't come from God, not at all. God will not encourage, he will not entice, and he will not allure anyone to do anything mentally or physically that he has commanded not to be done. God won't do that. God will not inspire or influence anyone to deviate from what is morally right and good. That we always have to remember. Temptation does not come from God in any form. It doesn't. Ever. But I'll ask this, and we'll touch back on it again. Will God allow us to be tested by temptations? The answer to that question is absolutely yes. Absolutely yes. We'll come back to that. Let's keep reading to see when temptations, and this is one way temptation happens. It arises. Keep reading to see when temptations happen or arise and why. Verse 14, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin, when it is full grown, it brings forth death." So it's interesting. I might have made mention of this here once before, but James, one of the apostles, he was a fisherman by trade before Jesus Christ called him. And these words that he uses in the Greek, it's interesting to see, as we'll go through them here in just a little bit, they have these, it's almost fisherman terms that he uses. And so, first of all, it says that the person is drawn. Each one is tempted when he is drawn. And this word drawn in the Greek is exelko. Exelko, and it means to lure, to be allured. I find that interesting. Like I said, he was a fisherman, to lure, but wait till we hear the other ones. He says he's drawn. The word drawn, like I said, means to be lured. By why? It says your own desires. You're lured away by your own desires. And the word desires here in this particular set of passage, it means to crave. To crave, to long after, desire to be something that's forbidden. So you're already thinking about something, and then maybe a thought comes in or something happens, and guess what? That kicks in. And it's a desire that you have already, and then it begins to lure you. You see what I'm saying? It begins to lure you like, oh, what are you going to do with it? Well, then he goes on to say, he says that you're tempted when you're drawn away by your own desires, and then this word enticed. And this is another, I look at it as a fishing term, because deliazo is the Greek, and it means to bait. You're first lured, and then you're baited. You're baited. And then once you're lured away from what is right and true by your own desires, we're told that you're baited to do what? To go forward to do something that isn't right. And when that happens, we're told that desire conceives. It conceives. And the Greek word for conceived in this particular passage here is Silimbano. Silimbano means to hook, to lure, to bait, and to hook. And then that is when sin comes on the scene. And to kind of help expound on this, I want to go to an example in Scripture that actually explains the how and why. Yes, we looked at this in Scripture. Let's go look and see how it actually transpires. So let's go back to 2 Samuel 11. And we're just going to read four verses here. In verse 1, we're told, "Now it came to pass in the spring of the year, at that time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that he was there." It says, "It happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of his house, the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold." Okay. So right here, he walked out on his roof. He saw this beautiful woman bathing on her roof. First of all, who bathes on the roof right in the view of the king's house? And we'll talk about that here in a second as well. But what did David do? Did David go, "Oh, I can't see that"? Nope. It says, so David sent and inquired about the woman. We're going to finish reading these four verses, and then we'll come back and talk about it. He says, "And someone said, 'Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?' And Uriah the Hittite was one of his mighty men. He knew him very well. Probably a good friend. It says, 'Then David sent messengers, and he took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house.'" Well, we read in just four verses, a lot happens. I mean, a lot happens. But I want to mention, this is my personal belief. It's not said in Scripture, and I don't like to go, my wife always says, "Be careful when you say this is your personal belief." Okay, the book of Nathan, chapter 2, verse 3, all right? No, I don't have a book, and I don't need a book. I don't want one. But anyhow, my thought on this is, I don't believe this all happened in one night. I really don't. I believe this took some time. What do you think happened when David was standing out there looking? Oh, he just kept looking. He's like, "Oh, that's nice." And I personally believe the one evening is when it all began. That's just my thought. But we're not told this, so I can't confirm that, but that's just my thought. But I would think that after David caught a glimpse of Bathsheba as she was bathing on the roof, it intrigued him. It intrigued him. Why did it get to the point that they both did what they did? Because I don't want to leave Bathsheba out of this. She's a guilty party in this just as much as he is. She was bathing on the roof for him to see. You know, after all, David, whenever he saw her, he didn't turn or push away, not at all, push away from what he saw. He didn't check at the door of his mind and kick it out. Go, "Oh, I can't see that. You know, she's a married woman." Well, maybe he knew that at the time. I bet he knew where Uriah lived. But instead, he began thinking about it. He began thinking about it probably more and more. And before long, he was drawn away. He was lured away from what was right by what? His desires. And by his desires, he then became enticed. And he became baited, and then he acted on what he desired. How? He inquired. He inquired. And guess what? It snowballed from there. He inquired. It's interesting to read in verse 4, "Then David sent messengers and took her." You know, I've read so many different commentaries on this. I've read different translations on this. And I don't see anywhere where she was taken by force. Not at all. It says, "And she came." She was intrigued as well. She was intrigued, and it became consensual. It was consensual. You know, she could have said, "Sorry, I'm married." She could have. But she didn't. Apparently, she didn't curb the thoughts either. And what happened? It snowballed. They committed adultery. And there was an unwanted pregnancy. from after having committed adultery. And then to cover it up, the murder of his own friend, his mighty man, and then the death of a young innocent child that was born. I mean, it all just snowballed. Because of what? Because David gave in to a temptation. Not only did he, so did Bathsheba. They both gave in to the temptation, what they desired. You know, Satan knows our weak spots. He does. Or the desires that we have. And many times, these desires, no one else knows. Except you, God, and Satan. Those are the only ones. And God will allow Satan to go about and to manipulate situations to see how we will respond. He will. He'll allow it. And Satan will do all that he can to tempt us to respond in a way that he desires. That's what he'll do. Do you think David or Bathsheba responded in the right way? Absolutely not. They did not. They responded to the temptation exactly how Satan wanted them to. Because if we don't push away, and we can learn from this, if we don't push away or walk away from things that are wrong, and instead we actually start to begin to focus on them and we think about them, we actually give Satan an opportunity to get us to give in to the temptation that he's throwing at us. We give him that opportunity. Because if we begin to think about it, that means we like what we're thinking about. It means that we like the temptation that's in front of us. We like what we don't push away from or walk away from. We become intrigued. And before long, if nothing's done about the intrigue, we become hooked. We become hooked. And guess what? Sin is at the door. Sin isn't far behind. And this can happen in so many ways, and it can happen to any of us. It truly can happen to any of us. Another example of when temptation happens. Let's go to the book of Job. Why the book of Job? Because temptations can happen during trials. And you may think, during trials? Yes, temptations can happen during trials. Trials are a time of testing, and guess what temptation is? It is a time of testing. You know, earlier I mentioned that God would allow temptations to test. And like I said, trials are a test. And temptations can come about during a trial. And I want to prove this. Job 1. Job 1. And we'll start in verse 1. And just kind of, we'll read just a few verses here. It says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." He didn't want it in his mind. He didn't want it there. He shunned evil. He says, "And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the East." He was very wealthy. It says, "Now his sons would go and feast in their houses each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with him. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.'" You know, Job wasn't even concerned about himself. He was concerned about his children. And he says, "Thus Job did regularly." So this is kind of sets the stage for what's getting ready to happen. This shows what kind of man Job is. He's a godly man. There's so much of this account. There's so much to take from it, and there's so much that he learned from all of this as well. But what I want to focus in on is what happened. In verse 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it.' Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing?'" And I don't think Satan went about saying it like, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" He's probably like, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" I can just hear the sarcasm in this. And he says, "Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land, because it's all because of you. Why do you think he fears you?" Why do you think he loves you? Why do you think he does what he does? He says, but now you stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. I can just hear the conversation. Adamant, sarcastic, and mean and rude. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on this person. And this just shows us right here that Satan can only go so far. God will say, that's it. And Satan has to stop at that point. And what did Satan do? No, I can't do that. No, it says, and Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And what did he do? He got busy. It says, now there was a day whenever his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their older brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And I want you to understand that this all happens in one day. He says, when the Sabaeans raided, he raided them and took them away. And indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God came from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. Who did all this, by the way? It wasn't God. It was Satan. He says, while he was still speaking, he says, and they consumed the servants and the sheep. He says, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Verse 17, while he was still speaking, another one also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, and yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking. You imagine here, the stage was set. This man is the greatest in the East. He's very wealthy. He has these sons and daughters that he loves. And he loves them so much that he goes to make intercession for them. He says, while he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young men, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Can you imagine all of that happening with just in a short period of time? Your whole life, literally, gone. Just like that. So then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And we're told in verse 22, in all this Job did not sin nor charge God with any wrong. Right here, we see where God allows temptations to test us during a trial. Do you think this was a trial? Absolutely, it was a trial. It was a tremendous trial. Do you think there was a temptation underlying all of this? Absolutely. What was that temptation? It was to get Job to reject God. That's what the temptation was. And what was Job's response? The Lord has given all this, and the Lord has taken it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I don't hear a word of curse anywhere or blame of God. It's a terrible trial. Yes, it is a trial, but Satan right here is trying to tempt Job. Let's continue. Chapter 2, verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, and a blameless and upright man, and one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause? And Satan's answered to God, skin for skin. He says, yes, all that a man has he will give for his own life. But you stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, he's in your hands, but spare his life. And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and I don't doubt it happened very quickly. It says he struck Job with, and it was Satan who struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And then Job's wife, the one who is to be his support in all of this, comes out to him and says, do you still hold to your integrity? And, wait a minute, isn't that what God told Satan? He said, Job holds on to his integrity. And then she says those exact words, and then she tells him, curse God and die. Who was it that told God that that's what Job would do? That was Satan. He says, he will curse you to your face. His own wife, Satan is using to do what? To tempt Job. To do that very thing. Job's wife encouraged him to do exactly what Satan told God that he would do to his face. What do you think was going through Job's mind in all of this? I mean, during the days after losing all that he had, losing his children, losing everything, all of his possessions, and then losing his health. Do you think there were a lot of questions going through his mind? Guarantee it. I guarantee there were a lot of questions going through his mind. The one question that no doubt I bet kept going through his mind was why? Why? Why, God, would you allow this to happen? Asking God why is not cursing God. It's asking a question. Why is this happening? Because in Job's mind, after all, I haven't done anything to deserve this. Why? And then Satan, in his evil, ruthless ways, tried to take advantage of this grieving man by getting Job's wife, his mate, who's to be there as a support, to say exactly what Satan was trying to get Job to do, curse God to his face. We're told what he says to his wife in verse 10. But Job said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And then it says, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. From out of the heart, the mouth speaks. All this, Job did not sin with his lips. Pretty impressive. You know, there are times temptation arises. When it arises, it comes during times of distress, times of trial. After all, Satan's not a fair fighter, guys. He's not. He loves to kick us while we're down. He surely does. And he knows that when we're weakened by distress, that whenever we're in distress and we're dealing with distress, and whatever that can be, this can be the loss, it may be the loss of a loved one, it can be health issues, it can be family issues, it can be marriage issues, it can be a loss of a job, it can be unforeseen issues that just crop up. There are so many things that can cause distress, but Satan, like I said, he's not a fair fighter, and he will do all that he can to tempt us to do something. What do you think that is? To give up. That's what he wants. Satan wanted Job to give up, just as he wants us to give up. And Satan wanted Job, he wanted to get into Job's mind, and he wanted Job to start thinking about what had happened and then formulate his own perception of reality and then begin to blame God for what was going on. To blame God for not intervening. And then these thoughts, if you allow them, you don't check them at the door of your mind, they'll consume you. And then you act on them by giving up. And Satan hadn't changed, not at all. He'll get us to do the same thing. Is giving up during a trial a sin? You bet it is. It is. Because we give in to the temptation to quit, to not rely on God. We desire to be done with the trial so badly that we get drawn to give up and not patiently wait for God to deliver and show us why he has allowed the trial and the temptation. We are told that he who endures to the end will be saved. That's what we're told. He who endures to the end will be saved. That enduring is through the temptations, the trials, and struggles of this life. A temptation and a trial both test our faithfulness to God and to his way of life. That's what it does. I have one last example of when temptations arise and why. And this example will show us that a temptation can come about by us being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or being somewhere we don't want to be, and something comes up. I want to go to Genesis 39. Genesis 39. Verse 1, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. He was sold by his brothers to the Ishmaelites. He says, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought Joseph from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. But remember, he was sold as a slave. He says, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with Joseph, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then Potiphar made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he'd put in Joseph's hand. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was in all that he had in the house and in the field. Things were going well for Potiphar because of Joseph. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Now it came to pass after these things that his master, Potiphar's wife, cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused. And he said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men were in the house, none of the men were inside, and he was in there by himself. He says, and when she saw that he was, let me get back where I was at, and that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled, and he ran outside. As far as we're going to read. Right here, I'm going to say Joseph found himself in a bit of a situation. He found himself in a situation. A situation he couldn't help. And this caused him to be, if you will, in the wrong place at the wrong time. But not because it was his doing. Not at all. I mean, Joseph just couldn't say, "Okay, I'm done. I'm out of here," because he was a slave. He was a slave. He was tasked with taking care of Potiphar's household. But there was this woman, Potiphar's wife, that Satan used to tempt Joseph. And we are told that she did so day by day. Can you imagine? Day by day by day. The same lady. I mean, like I told you, Satan's ruthless. Here, Joseph is in a situation that he can't get out of. He's a slave, and he's been given responsibility over all the household. What happens if he runs away? Well, maybe off with his head. Who knows? But he got to the point to where one day she literally grabbed him to fulfill what she wanted. And I truly believe Satan was really hoping Joseph would actually give in, because he had been pummeling him day in and day out with this woman's requests. Whenever she confronted him about it the first time, Joseph talked to her about it. He's like, "No, I can't do this." And ultimately he says, "I can't do this." And he goes, "And sin against God. This is evil. It's great wickedness." But what did he do this time? What's interesting, when you read it, it said he didn't say a word. He ran. And he took off so fast he left his clothes in her hand. He ran away from the intense temptation, because no doubt it was intense. He didn't stick around, slave or not. See, temptation sometimes just happens. Sometimes we can find ourselves in a precarious situation, but how we respond matters. That's what matters. How we respond is what matters. I give all of these examples because there's different examples for different temptations as Satan uses to get us to sin. He does. And that's all temptation is a means to get us to sin. That's what it is. But there are ways to overcome it. If you notice, I didn't talk about that. Yes, he ran. I did say that. But we really didn't discuss how to resist temptation. How to overcome temptation. And that's what I want to focus on for the rest of the message. How do we resist temptation? Well, I'll say at the onset, if we took anything away from the examples that we went over, we should have noticed a common theme or a common thread. Temptations are one or lost right here. They're won or lost between your eyes, your mind. Temptations are won or lost in the mind. You know, just at the beginning of the sermon, whenever I gave the little story about Tommy, there was a battle in his mind to steal the candy or not. You think about David. He let his desire to know more about the beautiful woman bathing on the roof to take over his mind. He lost that battle. For Job, think about how Satan tried to get Job to curse God because no doubt of the thoughts that continue to go through Job's mind day in and day and night, Job had to overcome those thoughts. He had to put them out. And for Joseph, he always had to continually remember what was right and what was wrong. And when the time came that he had to make a decision to stay or run, he ran. But where did they all begin? Right here. Right in the mind. Every temptation begins or ends in the mind. And it's interesting that Jesus Christ actually mentions that. In Matthew 5, he explains to us when things happen in the mind. Matthew 5, verse 21. We'll read a couple verses here, and I'll read a couple verses in another part of this chapter as well. In verse 21, it says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old," and this is Jesus Christ speaking, "you shall not murder." And that would be the physical act of murdering somebody. "And whoever murders will be in the danger of the judgment." And Jesus Christ says, "I say to you," and whenever you, that comes from his mouth, God in the flesh, Jesus Christ, our Savior. He says, "I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell." But he begins with, "I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother." Where does that begin? In your mind. It begins in the mind. And if you begin to focus on that and you begin to have thoughts over that, and you begin to start having these thoughts of somebody else in a derogatory manner or in a very wicked manner, you've already sinned. 27. "You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whosoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Like I said, it begins in the mind. So how do we protect our minds from temptation? How do we protect our minds from temptation? How do we not have forbidden desires? As Joseph said, wicked, great wickedness. How do we not have forbidden desires, great wickedness, stick around in our minds? How do we stand strong against making terrible decisions when faced between what is right and what is wrong? How do we do that? I want to go back to Ephesians 6. Ephesians 6. We're not going to go through this. I'm just going to touch on a couple things. Ephesians 6, verse 10. "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might." Ephesians 6, verse 10, now 11. "Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." In other words, the trickery and the schemings. What are part of his trickery and schemings? The temptations that he puts at us. That we may be able to stand against those that the devil puts out. He says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." We are told right here that we battle against the prince and power of the air. We battle to protect our minds from being affected with the temptations to do what is against God's way of life, to go against the boundaries that God has established. And to do this, how? He goes on to say in verse 13, "Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand it in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." In verse 14, "Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness." You know, it's interesting. We read these two, but there is one thing that's first and foremost that we read at the very beginning. The only way that we'll even be able to understand the truth, the only way that we'll be able to go forward and do what is right, the only way that we'll be able to battle against the temptations that are put against us, it's in verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of His might. Be strong in the Lord and the power of His might. In other words, we have to have God's help. We have to have God's help. How do we receive God's help? Well, we just read it in verse 14. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth. Let's stop right there. Girded your waist with truth. This tells us that we must, after we depend on God, we seek God, we believe that God is, and we want to do what it is God's telling us to do, we must know what is right and wrong. How can you battle against something that you don't know? We must know the truth. How? By not ignoring the truth. This is the truth. This is a huge part of your battle gear. The words of God, they tell us. God tells us what's right. He tells us what's wrong. He tells us the parameters that He's established. He even gives us examples of those who bypass those things, who gave in to the temptations. And He shows us what happens. And He shows us what happens to those who faithfully believe and continue forward and don't give up. He shows. He tells us. It's all right here. We dig into the Word of God. We know it. We get to know it. We learn it. And then we begin to understand what He desires of us. We don't just have a kind of a facade of an understanding. We have a deep understanding. And it strikes us to our core. And then we believe it. We believe what He says. And then it says, it goes on to say in verse 14, having put on then the breastplate of righteousness. And only those are the only two that we're even going to talk about. Because the breastplate of righteousness, is in other words, you go forward with what it is that you have learned and what it is you believe and what you know is right and what is wrong, and you go and you do it. Acting the way that God would have us to, from belief to action. And the only way that this happens is if we draw close to God, to get to know Him, connect with Him, and make what He says what we desire, and stay away from the things that are wrong and cling to what is right. And we're told back in Romans 12, verse 9, abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. That's what God wants us to do. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. And then we go back to Proverbs 3, verse 5 and 6, where it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Believe that. And then lean not on your own understanding. Don't let your mind get in the way. In all your ways, acknowledge God, and He will then help you through your paths in life. He will then guide you and lead you. But you've got to allow Him to do it. And then in James 4, this is kind of topping it off here. James 4. In verse 7. James 4, verse 7, therefore submit to God. Subject yourself to God's way of life. That's what he's saying. In everything that you do, subject yourself to God and His way of life. And he says, resist the devil. And that word resist means to be opposed to set yourself against. As Job did, shun evil. That's what God wants us to do. And it says the devil, he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. Well, we can go back to the example of Job. We go, wait a second. Even though Job, he shunned evil, he sought God, he still went through these things, and he was still tempted. But what did he not do? He didn't curse God. Who did he seek in this? God. But did he fully didn't understand God until God revealed Himself to him. And then he saw how off-base he even was. And we see how he repented and he says, I abhor myself. You can go back to chapter 42 of Job. Then he goes on in verse 8, draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. It sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. You draw near to God, submit to God, give yourself to him, and resist the devil and he will flee from you. That's encouraging, actually. It should be. But like I said, this doesn't mean if we diligently seek a relationship with God that temptations will never arise. But it is telling us that we will be able to overcome them with God's help. That's what it tells us. 1 Corinthians 10. Verse 12. It says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. I mean, we need to address that because we need what he's saying right here. Paul's telling the Corinthians, the church in Corinth, he says, you can't do this on your own. You think you can? You will fail. You just will. And then he goes on to say, no temptation is overtaking you except such as common to man. In other words, these things have been going on for some time. You're not new to this. And there are people, you can go back to Hebrews 12, those who have gone before us. I mean, we can see where they were faithful to the end. They battled temptations. And who was with them? Well, it was God. It says, look into our author and finisher of our faith, Jesus Christ. That's what it's all about. He goes on to say, he says, don't think that it's something that's uncommon. He says, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation, if you're seeking God and you're asking for his help, he says, he will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. He doesn't say he's going to take the temptation away. He doesn't say that at all. He says he will make a way for you to be able to bear it. You'll be able to bear it. In verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. And what he's saying here is just telling us that we need to stay away from anything that is against God's way of life. Period. Because this is where it all begins. If we stick around. And if we begin fleeing away from these things that are against God's way of life, that's where the bearing begins. We're able to bear these things because we are shunning evil. And like I said, it all begins right here in the mind. Temptations begin with thoughts. Sometimes, like I said earlier, they just kind of appear in the mind, but it matters what we do with them. But I will say thoughts are usually sometimes the result, and I say usually sometimes, are sometimes the result of what one surrounds themselves with. And that's something to consider as well. You go back to 1 Corinthians 15:33, evil company corrupts good habits. And that evil company isn't just people. It's whatever you surround yourself with. So this means that we have to check everything at the door of our mind. Everything at the door of our mind. So God wants us to do. Because he doesn't want us to open up ourselves to Satan and his temptations. God wants us to draw near to him. So 2 Corinthians 10. Some more admonition. 2 Corinthians 10. Verse 3. Here we're told, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. We've already touched on that. It says, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they are, as we even read back in Ephesians 6, they are mighty in God. For what? Pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments. And all that is something that's against God. That's all that is, something that exalts itself against God. Something, you can go all the way back to the Garden of Eden where Satan is doing all he can to exalt what it is that he's trying to promote against and over what it is that God has already established. That's what he does with temptation, to get us to go beyond what it is that God has already established. Something that exalts itself above what is right and true. That's all he's saying. He said the weapons that we use are mighty in God for doing just that, bringing them down. And then he goes on to say, he says that you must, he says, bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Jesus Christ. Every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. And then it says in verse 6, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. And I like how it says that, but That phrase, your obedience is fulfilled, is pretty much saying that you've made up your mind to do what's right. and you've done it, and you're doing it. That's what God wants us to remember. Bring every thought into captivity. Remember what it is that God has established. And to know those things that God has established, to be able to be strong in the Lord, to be able to stand firm in His might, we have to be close to God. You know, whenever anyone has any type of marital problems or they have any type of issues with other people, the first thing I ask them, I say, what is your study life and prayer life like? Because I'm telling you, my wife doesn't like it when I say that. I'm telling you, I'm not trying to be rude at all. It's just one of those Arkansasisms, I think. But I always ask, what is your prayer life and your Bible study life? Because it matters. I mean, you may think that that's just a simple question. Oh, why do I always get asked that? Well, why is that one of the questions? Why? Because it's the main crux of the problem. It's where it begins. Whenever we have a relationship with God that is breached because we don't spend the time on our knees and we don't spend the time seeking His way of life, we let Satan in the door. We absolutely let Satan in the door. And whenever we're so focused on what it is that we want, we're so focused on over here what we want, and we aren't seeking God how we want, we problems all exist. That's just what happens. So that's where we come back to what it is that Paul is saying here by bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Jesus Christ, knowing what is right and true, checking it at the mind and saying, wait a second, this is against God's way of life. I have to push it out. And if I'm getting these more and more and more, does this mean that I need to have a better relationship with God? It absolutely does. It absolutely does. We can go back to 2 Chronicles. I actually want to go back there. I know that we're bypassed. We're going a little bit far on our time. Back in 2 Chronicles, we have the account of where King Asa comes on the scene. I'll get there. 2 Chronicles. Actually, in chapter 14, 15, and 16 talks about King Asa. But he begins his reign in Judah, and whenever he begins his reign, he actually goes out and he starts implementing and removing the altars of the foreign gods and things like that, and striving to turn Judah back to God. That's what he's doing, and he's being very diligent in this. And when the time comes, the Ethiopians come up against them. I believe there was a million-man army with 300-some-odd chariots or whatever it was. You can read that in chapter 14. I encourage you to do so. If you don't remember the account of Asa, go back and read it, chapter 14, 15, and 16. But you can see where he started off great, and it was interesting to see what it was that was told to him in chapter 15. In verse 15, chapter 15, verse 1 of 2 Chronicles, it says, "Now the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. And he went out to meet Asa and said to him, 'Hear, Asa,'" and this is after he's begun making these reformations. It's after he has gone and he called out to God for the help to battle the Ethiopians, and God put them down. He goes on to say, "Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you were with him." That's important to always remember. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. And guess what? That hasn't changed. It absolutely has not changed. Asa ended up forsaking God. He ended up not seeking God. He allowed things to kind of hit this way. I mean, right after this was told to him, he went out and did more reformations. But then he became to where he became complacent. He became comfortable where he was at and what he was doing. They didn't have any war. They had peace for 30. There was no more war until the 35th year of his reign at the end of chapter 15. He got comfy. And he became reliant upon himself, and maybe he wasn't checking things at the door of the gate of his mind as much anymore. And whenever something came up to where he had the king of Israel come and start building a siege mound against him, he turned to the Syrians and gave them gold and silver and said, "Hey, come help us." What happened to him calling out to God? Well, when he didn't do that, in chapter 16, in verse 7, whenever he made this treaty with the king of Syria, he says, "And at that time Hananiah the seer, the prophet, came to Asa, king of Judah," in verse 7 of chapter 16, "and said, 'Because you have relied on the king of Syria and not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand. And he goes on to say, were the Ethiopians and the Lubim not a huge army with, he goes, very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. And that's something we should always remember. We rely on God, he will deliver us. And then in verse 9, for the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those who do what? Whose heart is loyal to him. Something we should all remember. We want God's help. We want God to help us in times of temptation. We want God to walk us through the trials of life. We want God to be there to help us to endure to the end, to work through relationship issues within our own lives. Guess what? We seek God. We seek his help. We rely on him. We rely on his help, not on our own. And God will deliver us. He will deliver us. We can resist and overcome any temptation in any circumstance with God as our help and our strength. But for this to happen, we must put in the effort to have a close relationship with God and daily seek his help and his guidance. And I guarantee you, if we do this, we will be able to withstand and resist anything, whatever the devil throws at us. We will. I want to go back to James 1, verse 12, and we'll end. James 1, verse 12. It says, blessed is the man who endures temptation. For when he has been proved, and that word proved, dokimos in the Greek, it literally means to be tried and found approved. He says he will then receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him.